This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Good to be here, Nate. Good to hear your voice.
Excellent. Happy winter solstice. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Kwanzaa. Did I miss any other holidays? Happy Hanukkah. What other holidays are we missing here?
Close enough.
Close enough. All right. So today's show, we're going to try to pack in a lot of material. And we may have a caller or two that calls in. So again, if you want to call in, you got a question, the number is 657-383-0751. Go ahead and call in, and then we'll take the question. But we also have a bunch of callers or listeners that emailed me and want to get their questions on the air. So we've got a lot of questions. So we're going to get to as many as we can today, and then all the rest that we don't get to, we'll get to in another show. But before we begin, I wanted to start off talking about a quote that I saw on Facebook. Now, of course, I read it on the internet, so it must be true. And this quote is supposedly by Sigmund Freud, and it talks a little bit. The quote is this: before you diagnose yourself with depression or low self-esteem, first make sure you are not, in fact, surrounded by assholes. Now, okay. It makes sense. I doubt he said this,
right?
But it was interesting. I wanted to bring it up on the show today because in a couple of the past shows, you've talked about this internal audience and how people get their internal audience from the external audience, from the actual people that they are surrounding themselves with. And so it seems to me that if you've got the wrong audience around you for a number of reasons or for whatever reason, that it can predispose you to kind of not feel completely calibrated about yourself. So what do you think about this quote, Dr. Lyle? What do you think about this?
Well, first of all, that I love that people are doing things like this. Let's take a look at this for a second. So they talked about how before you diagnose yourself with depression or low self-esteem. Well, first of all, notice the connection between depression and low self-esteem. So somebody is paying attention, and it turns out that if you actually research these things, you will find that the experience of low self-esteem and depression will correlate about 0.8. In other words, they are very highly correlated. They're almost exactly the same thing. They are not quite the same thing, but they're essentially, there's a huge causal relationship between the reports of low self-esteem and depression. Now, this is where, of course, psychologists are confused, and that is that this is what makes this quote both entertaining and interesting. So if you have a bunch of bad feedback from other people, that may make you depressed, but that doesn't necessarily do anything to cause your self-esteem to be low. It means your esteem is low. Okay, so you have real live negative feedback from other people. Your self-esteem may be very high. Your self-esteem is your internal audience and what your internal audience thinks of you. So you may be thinking that you're doing a great thing, and you may be doing some honorable, difficult, et cetera thing. However, there was a movie Tom Hanks did recently in the last two or three years where he went to Europe, or he was defending, he was an attorney, and I think he was defending somebody He was defending some Russian defector. I can't remember what the
Bridge of Spies.
Yeah, Bridge it was of something. Spies. I think he was defending a Russian spy, and so he was under tremendous. He got tremendous negative feedback from other people, but it was going to be potentially death to his career. However, he knew he was doing the right thing, and so he might have been down about the fact or depressed. Partially about the fact that it was a very, he was getting a lot of unpleasant feedback from all kinds of people. However, his internal audience was convinced that he was doing the right thing. So his self-esteem was not low, whereas his esteem was low. And so the your depression can come from both low esteem, and it can also come from low self-esteem. So often the esteem signals from other people are mimicking the signals that you get from yourself. So let me give you another example. Oh, this is one that infuriates me repetitively. And when a great athlete comes up a little bit short and they are second or third or fourth or whatever it is, and they were expected to win the gold or win the title, et cetera, and they are then produce a magnificent performance, but it is not quite good enough to win. And so it was only 99.8% enough, and it just wasn't quite enough. And so then some stupid jock with a microphone in their hand says, well, how does it feel? I'm sure this is a big disappointment. What went wrong? And et cetera. And then there's all kinds of criticism in the press about this athlete or this team and their performance. The truth is that their esteem has taken a big hit, but very often their self-esteem has not. Sometimes it has, but sometimes it hasn't. So the internal audience can understand that that individual did everything they possibly could, prepared brilliantly, performed brilliantly, but was beaten, at which point their internal audience can be proud of their effort and even of their performance. While the esteem signals from the outside are, you know, lousy. So this is the distinction between self-esteem and esteem. And so it is true, this is an entertaining quote, because if you are getting a bunch of negative esteem signals from people, it may be for legitimate reasons that you aren't doing such a good job. And your internal audience will check and think about how well you're doing, and you aren't doing very well, and you're getting negative feedback, and you are depressed, and your self-esteem is low, and you are depressed. However, you could also be getting negative feedback from a boss at work who's an idiot, a jerk, egomaniac, nutcase, etc., and you are, in fact, doing just fine. And so self-esteem can be intact, but you are in fact depressed or in a trap or just irritated. So yes, it makes sense to make sure when you are down and depressed about anything, make sure that this is not just an environmental issue where we're getting some negative feedback, and let's make sure that we are doing what we can to mitigate the situation as well as possible, and check whether or not, you know, what if there's a difference between the self-esteem and the esteem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always loved these brilliant quotes from Sigmund Freud, you know.
Yes. Yeah. We could have just stopped it after a couple of minutes because that was really fun. All right.
That's great because it makes sense. You've got to figure out which is which, right? It's not always everybody else. It might just be you. Right. It might be that you're not doing enough to get the right steam signals from people.
Right. Yes. And in fact, it gets, obviously the nervous system is pretty sophisticated in the sense that it tends to be the case when you get negative feedback from the world. What it does is it not only the negative esteem signals makes you depressed, but it also lowers your self-esteem. So the self-esteem mechanism goes through a recalibration oftentimes, where essentially what happens is that you lower your expectations for yourself. And it is not a pleasant thing to lower your expectations for yourself, but it is in fact necessary. The nervous system is designed by nature to have you optimally set goals and utilize your talents in pursuit of survival and reproductive gains. That's what it does. So let me give you an example. Let's suppose that you are, we're going to dream up a really clueless guy that is 17 years old and he's a senior in high school and he's just kind of a little bit socially out of it. We're going to mythically make this guy somebody that is not calibrated. And let's suppose that he's average attractive. So, of course, following a non-sophisticated, non-socially sensitive instinctual program, he goes and hits on, you know, the homecoming queen. That's who he wants to take to the prom. Well, she says no. Okay? So then he goes to on the first princess, one notch down. She says no. Then he goes to the next one. Then he goes to the next one. And he goes 0 for 5 on homecoming court. And then he goes to the next most attractive girl, etc. He keeps getting no. Now, in principle, what we might expect is that the nervous system would become depressed with repeated failure. And so what it's going to do then is it's going to lower the self-esteem, which is the internal audience's expectations for performance. So it's going to start saying, listen, chief, maybe you better quit trying to hit on the top 1% of this high school class, and maybe you ought to head down 20 percentile, head down into the 80th percentile range, and give it a shot there and see what happens. And so prior to this, he would not have found that acceptable because he was not calibrated there. But by starting at the top, i.e. he was Mr. Clueless, then he starts to work his way down, and the self-esteem mechanism, although it feels disappointing to find out that you don't have the chops to play there, it is a necessary recalibration in order to lower your own standards so that when you make efforts that are appropriate in the arena where it's appropriate, even if you fail, the self-esteem mechanism will support you and it will encourage you to continue. So obviously, in this case, the way it's going to work is it's going to be much more sensitive, which is that let's suppose our boy is about a 7, and let's suppose he's not so stupid. He begins by hitting on a 9, and he goes nowhere, and he tries one more 9, and he goes nowhere. Now he's getting depressed and a little down on himself. So now he sets his sights to an 8. He hits on an 8. He loses there. He hits on another 8. He loses there. Now he feels a little bit further down on himself. So now he hits on a 7 who says yes, and now he's excited. Okay? So now what the system does is it gives him exciting feedback for a goal that he attains now, where it would not have given him an excitement for a goal that he until he had been recalibrated. You see, this is how this works. So so the movement of the self-esteem mechanism together with depression that will come from negative feedback, either from outside or from inside, these are essential components to how the esteem mechanisms and mood regulating systems work.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. It's kind of like I'm back in high school.
No. Yeah. Just kidding. Well, you never really leave. That's how it actually works.
All right. Well, you mentioned the situation with the boss and potentially a bad boss, a good boss here and there. So this leads right into our first question from our listeners.
Okay.
So, dear Dr. Lyle, I love the way you explained left and right wing of politics. The left has more uncertainty about income and good supply, while the right has more. And this got me thinking, conflict sounds similar. Employees think that they are underpaid and overworked, while the owner thinks he's overpaying them and they are lazy. Unlike an entrepreneur, a wage worker has very little motivation to increase productivity since he's essentially earning the same wage. Are we talking? Do you think we are talking about the same kind of circuits here? Are humans made to work for other people? And can you talk about this?
Yes, the listener is ferreting their way into the critical issue. So yes, there's a similar theme that's involved here, and what the theme is the calibration of fairness in exchanges. And so it's going to turn out that human beings they may not, they didn't, quote, work for other people per se, but they sort of always did in the sense that they were always trading. And sometimes they weren't trading. There would have been circumstances where they were a direct return hunter-gatherer that literally went out and got his own food. But even within very small villages, there was constant trading processes going on between humans. And so we know this from looking at hunter-gatherer societies today, so as a result, it's going to turn out that trades is where the action is at, and trade is where is what these things that we're talking about are happening. So in the case of left-right politics coming from essentially the social welfare processes that go on in a Stone Age village, the exchanges that are taking place there are that the more competent are essentially paying more for lesser insurance, but it's the only insurance that they can get. If you're the most competent hunter in the village, you are providing more for the village than somebody who is the least competent. And in fact, if he goes down and he's in trouble, you are insuring him and you are more competent than he is. And if you go down, he is insuring you and he's less competent than you are. And so, of course, there is a frustration and a dynamic tension there where there's criticism that goes back and forth between the most competent and the least competent. And those are the dynamics. And fundamentally, what's going to happen is the more competent people are going to be stingy and irritated about this, and they're going to be trying to reduce their output. And the least competent people are going to feel like that the more competent are going to be too stingy and also very critical, et cetera. So what the criticism is anger, which is being directed from the more competent people to the least competent people in order to cause guilt reactions, because that anger is effectively a threat that we're going to kick you out of the village. And so those are threats in order to activate guilt, which is going to activate concessions, which is to put out more energy and earn the insurance and material support that you get. So this is what this is. So at the bottom line, what's happening here is that they are trading, and so they're negotiating and they're threatening each other, et cetera. And that's exactly what's going on between employer and employee. They are in an exchange process, and exchange processes take place because it's in both people's best interest. However, that doesn't the analysis does not stop there. So we're gonna break this down to a very simple example so that people can understand the fundamental process that's taking place here. And it's an important one, not just for employee-employee relationships, but this is also standard in all relationships and in particularly in man-woman dynamics. So this is a very important principle. So what's going to happen is that exchanges take place because both parties are better off. But the question is, how much better off are they? So let's suppose that, you know, I have a hill full of bananas and you have a hill full of oranges, and we meet at the river in between, and I bring down 10 bananas for your 10 oranges, and we swap at the bottom of the river every week. The problem is that I recognize that you are happy to do so, and you recognize that I'm happy to do so, which means that I'm motivated to possibly next week bring down 9 bananas and hope that you bring 10 oranges. And so that's in this way, I am chiseling into what's called the consumer surplus in the exchange. So the reason why these people are exchanging is because both of these animals are running cost-benefit analysis on what they get for the energy that they put out, and they've determined that the exchange is in their best interest. So the question is, how much in your best interest is it? And the answer to that is sort of a mysterious computation that's taking place along, you know, some very complicated and subtle neural circuits, trying to figure out whether this is worth doing. Now, if it's worth doing, the odds are that it's not just barely worth doing. The odds are that it's quite considerably worth doing. So this is useful to understand in the modern environment with respect to pricing. So essentially everything you buy in the modern environment is underpriced, and sometimes it is substantially underpriced. In other words, you would pay an awful lot more for it if you had to. It's a tremendous deal. There's great consumer surplus in what it is that people are purchasing. Now, in the Stone Age, the same thing was taking place. So those oranges for the bananas, both of us are better off. So the question is, if you've got 10 oranges over there and you're looking at my 10 bananas, those 10 oranges, would you be willing to part for how many bananas? Let's suppose it's 5, okay? In that case, 5 for 10 is still worth you doing it for you, but 5 for 10 is way more worth it to me. So there's tremendous surplus in this exchange. And from the same angle, let's suppose that I would trade 10 of my bananas for 5 of your oranges. So neither one of us knows what the other one's map is, except that we do know that 10 for 10 is acceptable, and therefore 9 for 10 is probably also acceptable. So this means that both of us are motivated to chisel the other one by bluffing that we are right on the edge, and actually that we don't need the deal at 10 out of 10, but we will now be willing to do the deal for 9 of my bananas for 10 of your oranges. Now, you on the other side are designed by nature to try to make sure that you don't get taken advantage of in exchanges. So you are going to be just as determined to chisel me and to see where the contours of my motivation are with respect to the consumer surplus. And so they could be at different locations. So, for example, it may be worth it for me to trade 8 bananas for 10 oranges, but it's not worth it for me to trade 8 bananas for 7 oranges. So 10 for 10 is right on the line, and you better not try to push me 1 inch. You wouldn't have any idea where my line is. I might be willing to give you 10 bananas for 1 orange, for all you know. So all you know is that you've got a sense of where your consumer surplus line is, you know, where what you're willing to go to, and you're watching me. And so human beings are very good at sort of reading each other's excitement in exchanges. And so this happens in man-woman dynamics. If you're too excited that girl said, yes, she's going to go out with you, she's instantly recomputing whether or not this was a very good deal for her. Okay, so people are naturally designed to be picking up on these excitement cues and to try to figure out how much consumer surplus there is in the middle of this exchange and where the trade-off points cross for both players and essentially, you know, where it is that it's an even deal. Now, so this means that people are designed to chisel. They're designed to test and chisel and roll back a few percent of their goods or their effort and see whether they can still get the 10 oranges. So I'm going to come down there with 9 bananas and see if I can still get 10 oranges. And when you come down there with 9 oranges, I'm like, oh, no, I can't give you that. I've only got 8 bananas. And so we go back and forth and we jockey and we test to see when the other person is willing to walk away. Now, this is very typical in romantic relationships. And this is what I call the chiseling chip. So you've got a chip in your head that recognizes there's consumer surplus in the middle of these exchanges, and you are motivated to see whether or not you can still get everything that you want, but you can put out 10% less energy. So, and so this is what couples will very often do. So it begins with essentially both people are typically over-signaling they're over-signaling their value and under-signaling their deficiencies in order to entice a good bargain into a relationship. This is nothing other than sales. So this is just exactly what all sales and marketing does, is that they overpromise and underdeliver. This is just standard operating procedure. So this is what's happening in human romance. This is why both parties are really quite excited. They know intuitively that they are overselling their assets and underselling their liabilities, but at the same time, they can't see it on the other side of the equation, and so they're biting at the bit, and they're wanting to make this exchange, and that's what we call falling in love. Now, Now,
I love these. I love this. We're covering everything here.
So then what we're going to expect to see is we're going to expect to see some chiseling. And so we, and you know, we're not sure who's going to chisel first and what it's going to look like. But as they go through this process, if one person starts chiseling pretty hard and the other one keeps conceding, then that's a signal to the person who's doing the chiseling that they are in a position of power in this relationship and the other person may not be that great. And therefore, this may not be that great a deal for them, and that would reinforce continued chiseling. The you could see how that can work. So this is these are just animals negotiating, and if I snarl at another animal and take his lunch and he doesn't do anything back, then I'm going to take the whole thing. And that's exactly what we would expect to be taking place here. So yes, the question is a very good one. So it goes much deeper than just left ring and white ring politics. It goes through the entire exchange process of humans generally, and it absolutely goes through employer-employee relationships. It's exactly what this is the chiseling chip is operating alive and well in all parties to those transactions. So we would expect that the employer would feel like they're overpaying their employees and that they're getting a lousy work ethic out of them. And we would expect that the employees feel like they're being overworked and underpaid. And this is the way the chip is built. It's built to make sure that you are essentially greedy and irritable and defensive and aggressive about bluffing your position to make sure that you get your share of the consumer surplus. If you're too much of a nice guy and too eager to make the exchange, then the person on the other side is very likely to get the lion's share of the consumer surplus that sits inside of this potential transaction, and you will be exploited. So as a result, what has happened is that the average human has evolved a mechanism that makes them not fair in the way that they analyze their own contribution to a trade. They overestimate what they are bringing to the party, and they underestimate their liabilities, and this sets them up to be moderately disagreeable. In other words, they are not fair. The average person is actually not a fair analyzer of what it is that what they bring to the table. They are reasonably fair, but they are not fair. And this you can obviously see this in any sports fan who consistently feels like their team, when they lose, got the short end of the stick of the refereeing, but never thinks that their team won because they got a better than even break on the refereeing. So this is clearly a ubiquitous characteristic of human nature, and this is the chiseling chip's roots come with respect to the problem of consumer surplus and making sure that you don't get out negotiated out of it. So all humans have triangulated on what we're going to call an evolutionarily stable strategy, which is to be mildly disagreeable in exchanges and to test the weakness on the other side in the exchange in order to see if you can improve the cost benefit for yourself in that process.
Yeah, it reminds me. I was visiting Israel on a trip, and it was a hot day, and I was with my friends, and we're walking around, and it's hot, and so I wanted something to drink, so I stopped by at one of the little carts in one of the cities, and she pours me like a sweet tea or something like that, some sort of lemonade, and she gives me the price, and I was like, okay, thanks, and I pay her, and I come back, and the tour guide that was with us, he goes, congratulations, you just paid $8 for something it took her 1 minute to make.
Yeah.
And I didn't even think to negotiate about it, you know.
Right.
I didn't even think.
Yes, it's actually interesting that what has taken place in the United States and some other places is the elimination of the price negotiation. And so that's an interesting and very positive cultural evolution with respect to small transactions. That in other countries have not gotten there yet, and so it's startling and annoying to realize that in many places you actually have to spend the time to fuss and fiddle to fight over a few dollars, otherwise that they will fleece you behind this issue. So there you go.
Yeah.
That's the tip. Yeah.
All right, next question. Okay, this has to do with man-woman dynamics and languages of love. So, okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, I used to think that I understood the concept of esteem dynamics as explained by you. I thought that positive esteem is easy to distinguish. But recently, I became aware of a book called The Five Languages of Love by Gary Chapman. The book describes five ways of sending positive esteem signals. And the premise is that there can be a miscommunication in the kind of esteem signaling that takes place. My question is, do people indeed have different preferences as to the kind of esteem they are susceptible to? For instance, if a man craves physical touch, but his partner sends esteem via kind language, the man may perceive shortage of esteem signals and may appear needy as he is supposedly missing the cues he is seeking. Is this kind of miscommunication a real one, or can it be explained from an evolutionary standpoint as a woman simply not desiring the man physically?
This is a great question. And I'm going to say that I believe that I don't want to give a 100% answer here. My answer is going to be 97% that this is bogus and 3% where 3% wiggle room for a little bit of it. Now, I want you to imagine that let's take away explicit conceptual speech, and we're going to get this down to there's actually five methods of communication for humans that we know of. We don't believe they communicate by smell. So the five methods are words, voice tone, body posture, facial expression, and touch. So those are going to be the five methods that human beings use to communicate. So if we were to take words out of it, which words didn't used to be in it before we evolved language. So then we've got voice tone, body posture, facial expression, and touch. Pretty good. Pretty good. Really good communication. So these are the same communication signals that my cat gives me. Now, the truth is that I almost never misread what that cat, you know, what their emotional tone is and sort of what it is that they want and what it is that they're up to. So I would not expect that human beings, having evolved nonverbal communication to the nth degree and to have it be a critically important function of mating dynamics, that we would miss the cues. I think we get them, okay? Now, I think that I think of what is being sold in this book is the notion that, oh my God, you're really more in love than you think, but the two of you, poor you, you know, you're not using the right love language, and so you don't really get to know just how secure and wonderful and how happy your partner is about you. I think that's totally bogus. Okay, so the truth of the matter is people are extremely effective at communicating how much they value their partners, and they calibrate those signals beautifully. And there's a great deal of research that actually indicates this. I'm not going to cite it chapter and verse, but I can certainly give you a couple of examples that come off the top of my head. Example number one is that in research on whether or not people are having affairs, it turns out that when one partner suspects that the other partner is having an affair, they are essentially almost always right. In other words, if it turns out they're not literally having an affair, they are very, very likely considering that having an affair. They're very close. Okay, so right away, the research is backing up the fact that people are picking up the correct signals, even when their partners are attempting to mask them. Okay, so that's very interesting. So the notion that we could have a wonderful, fabulous relationship that is actually being choked to death by the fact that moron over there doesn't know how to say I love you with his hands or his you know, cooing or his voice or, you know, buying flowers or whatever the hell it is that these people think is going to help the situation is essentially almost always wrong. Now, is it always wrong? Probably not. Okay, so there's going to be people that are essentially 17% of an autistic, you know what I mean, that are a little clumsy, that that essentially are bull in china shops, et cetera, and miss some cues now and then, and that can be frustrating, and et cetera. So do I think that there's absolutely nothing to the idea of miscommunication? No, I don't think that there's absolutely nothing to it, but I think there's almost nothing to it. I think people communicate their esteem through multiple channels. They do so extremely well. They calibrate the messages with extraordinary precision, and those messages are picked up, okay, and people feel them, and it may not be what a person wants to feel because they may be in a marriage 7 years in and a couple of kids, and it turns out that the signals that they're getting are not that great, and then they're going to go to therapy, and they're going to work on their love language. And they're not going to improve the situation very often by that kind of strategy.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that. We pick up on all kinds of cues that are nonverbal. Because I was playing poker with a couple weeks ago or so, and I was at a table where there was a very good poker player, and mm-hmm. the hand went down where he was in a hand with an inferior player who was just a novice, just having a good time. Well, the hand went down all the way to the last card, and the inferior player bet really big. And of course the very experienced guy called, and of course the guy was bluffing, and he ended up the experienced one ended up winning the pot. And the inexperienced player said, "Well, how could you call me there? I bet so big. It was clearly a bluff." And the guy said, "Well, it wasn't just that." And he named off, there was like six other things the guy was doing.
Yeah.
The guy probably noticed like 20 things, but he only named six of them that indicated that the guy was bluffing. And so it was like, holy moly, this guy really paid attention to a lot of other things rather than just what the guy said, which is, "Hey, I've got a big hand."
Right, exactly. So that's a beautiful example of the fact that there was a whole bunch of stuff that the novice player was attempting to mask and couldn't mask it. And so you can attempt to mask that you're not that into your spouse and you're interested in the girl at the office, but you're not going to mask it. She's not going to get it. I mean, she's going to pick up on it. And if you're a girl, you can try to mask and misdirect your spouse and to not have him thinking that you're not that into him. But he'll know. He will know, and he will feel it right down into his bone marrow. So no, I think five love languages is a my understanding of it. I haven't read the book. I think I read a few paragraphs, which is all I felt like I needed to read. And you know what I mean? You only have so much time in this world, and this is obviously pop psychology. And so this is hopeful opiate for the masses in mediocre relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, next question. Okay, next question is, "Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a 19-year-old male. I struggle to find energy and the ability to concentrate in the morning, and I sleep in whenever I can. I'm often wide awake and full of energy when the sun goes down until about midnight when I finally get tired and get to sleep. But I've been told that this is standard for males of my age. Do you believe that my alertness at night is partly due to the fact that in the Stone Age, adolescent males were adapted to switch on in the evening as routine time for mating, with the darkness providing privacy from the rest of the village? Therefore, males, as the initiators of sex, would have had to be alert to secure a mate and fend off other males from their women, maybe like the modern-day equivalent of nightclubbing. Did humans typically stay up a little longer after sunset around the campfire?"
You know, nice question. Nice question. I just love that this is a 19-year-old that's listening and thinking and learning about evolutionary psychology, you know, at that age, and trying to put this together. And there's little elements of truth probably in a lot of the things that he's thinking here. But the main thing that you're thinking, or the main thing that you're hypothesizing, is incorrect. So let me tell you, all you have to do to find out if this is true is go out into the woods. So go out into the woods, go camping somewhere in the High Sierras or some other place, and bring yourself a flashlight with limited batteries. And that's it. That's the light that you have. And you've got the ability to light a fire because you've got some matches and you're going to cook food out there. You got your little Coleman stove maybe. And we're just going to find out how late you stay up. And we're going to find out that you're not going to stay up that late after dark. You'll stay up for a while, but you're not going to stay up that late. And so what's happening here is that, and we're going to add something to the equation. We're going to have you backpack for about, 12 miles a day. And then we're going to see what that feels like at the end of that day and whether or not you're up till midnight and then sleep until 9 or 10 in the morning. That's not what we're going to find. Two things are involved here. Number one, many people in our society do not work very hard at all. So they do essentially almost no physical labor, and they do very modest amounts of exercise. And so as a result, they are not physically exhausted at the end of the day the way that very many animals are and that our ancestors would have been in their natural history. You need more sleep to recover from a day where there's been hard labor. So that's one thing that's not happening with these 19-year-olds and these young people. They're in college and they're staying up till all hours of the night, et cetera. Second of all, they have the electric light. And so the electric lights are keeping people up. If you shut them all down, their behavior would be very much different. So we know from worldwide studies where the electric light is not prominent that people are sleeping many more hours and they're going to bed a lot earlier than they are where we have the lights. So good question, interesting question. Certainly, I don't doubt that people certainly would stay up a little bit past dark with their fires and talk a little bit and some romancing going on there. Obviously, but no, the answer is nobody's staying up till midnight. And so your quote problem with this is completely and utterly artificial. And all you have to do is go do shift work starting at 7 a.m. at a quarry and work at that quarry until about 5 p.m. in the afternoon. And I will expect that you will be home, abed, and asleep by 7:30, and you'll be happy to get that sleep, and you will miraculously discover a sleep cycle that will look like darkness and night. I mean, darkness and light. That's what's going to happen.
Very interesting. Love it. He had a follow-up question that looks like you answered, but he was basically asking, he's a Caucasian living in Australia, which is a significantly mm-hmm. warmer climate with longer
right.
days depending on location, time, year. And so mm-hmm. so he said, could one's intuitive sleep patterns be in sync with the day-night cycles of where their genes evolved?
I doubt that. In other words, it's going to turn out that it's going to be the light of the area that is going to be that's going to be dictating this, and so we're going to be sensitive. We are very photosensitive. Our skin is photosensitive. So as a result, no, I don't think so. That is a great question, and it's a very interesting one. And it is he could be right. In other words, it's possible that could be true, and that I would have to say that at this moment, some sleep researcher probably knows, but my gut instinct as to what it is that I know about sleep research and I know about humans and the setting of the circadian rhythm and how it works, my answer would be it's exceedingly unlikely that that's the case.
Okay. Yeah, this guy really seems like he's been thinking about this, because he followed up saying that he's heard that hermit crabs can intuitively tell exactly what time the tide is going to rise, even when they're hundreds of miles from. So he's thinking maybe humans have a similar mechanism for sleep. But that's a great question.
Yeah, very good question. And it, for all I know, there could be a little bit of truth in it. I've never seen anybody even address that question or hypothesize it, and I don't. My answer is I don't believe so. I think that's very unlikely.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, our next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a biracial male, age 30. My mother is a white American. My father is from Africa. However, I'm almost completely culturally, quote, white because I've been surrounded by white people growing up. I've mostly dated white women because I'm culturally more compatible with them. But having a different ethnic appearance from them makes me feel uncomfortable as if we do not match. Do you have any advice for biracial people looking to date for pair bonding, but have a hard time because they do not belong to any particular tribe?
Boy, that's a very interesting question. And so clearly we've got someone who is, got a lot of natural empathy and sensitivity. So this is not some jerk that is not sensitive to cues that he's picking up. So he's picking up some subtle cues, and it's a little disturbing, and he's a little uncomfortable, et cetera. 30 years old. Well, I'm not sure what to tell you, except that we're all out here. We're all essentially niche marketers trying to find, in the case of pair bonding, we're trying to find a needle in the haystack. And however that marketing is taking place, a lot of different ways to do that. Certainly everybody that's in repeat exposure environments that is hitting on people is going through a process of flirtation, and that's a very feedback-rich process. So we don't have to worry that we're offending anybody because we are a little, biracial and therefore a little bit off. They will, in terms of what they might normally get hit on by, because, for example, women are getting hit on by a whole variety of people, and so we are just another variant, whoever it is that you are. And certainly, if you're using online methods like a Match.com or such things, you've got photography. And so the photography is helping you self-select for a market that has no problem at all with your looks. So this is, we all essentially bring unusual characteristics relative to the bell curve to the table. So this is just one more. I don't think that if this individual or any other such individual is in a situation with a partner that is giving them very good feedback and they want to be with that partner, that they're attracted to that partner, I don't think that would stand up for very long, that sort of feeling of discomfort. Perhaps it would, but I would expect that in a relationship with security and positive feedback, I think those problems are probably going to fade away. That's what I think.
Okay. Great. Okay, next question. Dr. Lyle, I love the show.
Incidentally, I want to point out that this is a little bit, we're sort of catching something in midstream here. And that is that, 50 years ago, a black person and a white person together was scandalous. And cause for grave concern and upset, et cetera, et cetera. By the 1980s, much less so, still uncomfortable, okay? By 2017, it is still cause for sort of comment, and it's not like people don't notice, but it is much, much reduced. The level of social disturbance is, 15% of what it would have been 50 years ago. And so I understand and have empathy for the situation. This person being biracial is one whole notch over in terms of he looks then even closer to one tribe or the other. So as a result of this, I think this is quite small potatoes. Not enough to stop a person and not enough to get gun shy at all. But I do understand the situation, and it's and of course there's going to be some mild discomfort there. But fortunately, the future is going to be continue to just get better. 10 years from now, it's going to go from a 15% issue down to an 11% issue, and 20 years from now, it'll be a 6% issue. So this is fading fast as the world transports more people. There's more sort of interbreeding of different racial groups, and the world starts to have hybrids all over the place. And we observe them on a daily basis, increasingly without comment.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next question. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm wondering if learning disabilities, specifically dyslexia, and differences in the way kids learn could develop due to a stressful childhood. Since a diagnosis of dyslexia is based on neuropsych testing, could a lack of nurture and attentive parenting create these results patterns? Or are the neuropsych tests able to evaluate the brain independent of nurture and something like dyslexia being gene predetermined? And then by stressful, I mean basic needs were met, but parents were having difficulties in the marriage. Generally caring, but distracted and stressed parents. I have a few generations of dyslexics in our family, and I've read that it's genetic, but my therapist suggests that it is because we each did not get what we needed as children.
You know, sorry. I mean, the therapist is just totally uneducated. And this is an example of a therapist that comes from the sort of hybrid ignorance of dynamic and learning theory. That believes that early childhood experiences are shaping the tree, how it grows. No, the answer to the question is that this is a brain, you know, problem, or actually abnormality is the way I would say it. It isn't necessarily a problem. It's a problem in the modern environment, and these are going to be genetic. I'm not going to rule out that some kind of neurotoxin could potentially cause brain damage in utero, but it certainly has nothing to do with emotional feedback systems in development. It has nothing to do with the nurturing process at all. So, no, that's just a utterly ludicrous, and that therapist is, what can I tell you, way behind the times, irresponsible. This always seems to be such a safe place for therapists to go to blame things on, and it seems kind and wise and deep, but really it's not kind, and it's moronic and it's irresponsible. And no, the answer is that these things have nothing to do with whether or not the parents were stressed or anything else under the sun. This is not a process that takes place in that way. The dyslexia, by the way, is unlikely to be associated with any really functioning problem of the way the mind is built. If you can think and realize that 6,000 years ago there wasn't any language, didn't exist. So the notion of having troubles with the written language first of all, very few people did any reading 200 years ago, almost nobody. So the general public didn't know how to read, you know, until very, very, very recently. So the fact that the human mind has the ability to read, you know, most normal humans have the ability to pick this up and not screw things up and not read letters backwards and just essentially struggle with this process. Does not mean that if you do struggle with the process that there's anything in principle wrong with your brain. It just means that this magnificent trick of written language is only bestowed cleanly on, you know, 98 or 99% of people, and there's a couple of percent of people that the chip doesn't work perfectly in the way that it does with everybody else. And so irrespective of intelligence, you can obviously low intelligence people have limited ability to use written language, but dyslexia covers the board. You can be exceedingly intelligent and be dyslexic, and as a result, yeah, you can do not very well in school, not nearly as well as your intelligence would dictate, and you're going to be shut out of a lot of professions that you would not normally be shut out of. This has, of course, nothing to do with your childhood development. This is just straight brain wiring. It turns out that dyslexics, very bright dyslexics, will usually wind up in some kind of sales or entrepreneurial activity. That's because of their intelligence would generally shunt them toward professions. And yet there's most of the professions require, as a bar to get into the profession, they require high performance on different kinds of testing and performance in school, which may have nothing to do with the ability to do the job, but they create a barrier to entry for a lot of things. And so as a result, dyslexics are then forced into sort of more free-flowing, creative, entrepreneurial types of activity. And there they are, actually, in sales and marketing, they are vastly overrepresented relative to other professions when a dyslexic has a high intelligence and they suffer from dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So anyway, hopefully that answers that story.
Fantastic. Well, I think we will end there, and we will get to the last couple of questions the next show we do with listener emails. So, Dr. Lyle, thank you very much. Have a wonderful holiday.
Absolutely. Pleasure, and I'll talk to you all soon.
All right. Sounds good. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.